This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Jeff Jackson, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
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 You're listening to Rock is Lit with Christy Halberg. Rock on, Christy.
Is lit.
Hey, lit listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Rock is Lit, the first and still only podcast devoted to rock novels, and also the 2024 American Writing Awards Podcast of the Year in the categories of music and arts. Rock is Lit is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Jimmy Kimmel, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcast.
Rock is Lit is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Christy Alexander Halberg, author of my own rock novel, Searching for Jimmy Page. Special shout out to this semester's Rock is Lit interns, production intern Cater Jones, and social media intern Jenna Rudolph. Find out more about me and Rock is Lit on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Christy Halberg. Visit my website at ChristyAlexanderHalberg.com. And for goodness sakes, subscribe, comment, leave a 5-star rating and all that good stuff on your podcast platform of choice. Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I thank you for your support.
Ladies and gentlemen, the show starts in 3, 2, 1.
We've come a long way, babies. 50 episodes. We're celebrating this milestone with a sort of redux of the very first episode, which featured Jeff Jackson and his novel, Destroy All Monsters, the last rock novel. A story that centers around the killing of bands as they perform on stage by members of their own audience. In the last segment of that episode, Nathan D. Duval, host of The Lucid Show on 103.3 Asheville FM, popped in to talk about real-world examples when that sort of violence has erupted at live shows. Jeff and Nathan are back for episode 50. Good times. In fact, we had such a good time that this episode is divided into two parts. In this first part, Jeff and I talk about his debut novel, Mira Kapora, a coming-of-age story for people who hate coming-of-age stories, featuring a colony of outcast children, teenage oracles, amusement parks haunted by gibbons, perplexing cassette tapes, and a reclusive underground rock star who has gone missing. Throughout the episode, you'll hear songs by Jeff's band, Julian Calendar, all of which you can download from Bandcamp. Check the show notes for the episode playlist. In part two, coming very soon, Nathan D. Duval and this semester's Rock is Lit intern, Cater Jones, join me to talk about actual musicians who, like the rock star in Jeff's novel, mysteriously disappeared. Make sure you subscribe to Rock is Lit so you won't miss that. But now, enjoy part one of episode 50 with Jeff Jackson. Jeff is the author of several highly acclaimed novels, including Destroy All Monsters, Novi Sad, and Mira Kapora, His short fiction has appeared in a variety of journals and been performed in New York and Los Angeles by New River Dramatists. Jeff holds an MFA from NYU and is the recipient of fellowships from the McDowell Colony, Baryshnikov Arts Center, and Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. He lives, writes, and makes music with his band Jillian Calendar in Charlotte, North Carolina. Before we dive into our convo about Jeff's debut novel, Mira Kapora, have a listen to an excerpt from the book read by Jeff. At this point in the story, the main character, also named Jeff Jackson, has just been gifted a strange cassette tape that he'll later discover is a bootleg recording of the final performance of Ken Mersey, the indie rocker who has seemingly vanished into thin air.
There's this tape. It arrives one morning in the mail, which is surprising because I don't have an address. I'm between places, as they say. Specifically, I'm shuttling between a cardboard refrigerator box in the alley next to the Emerald Mountain Chinese restaurant and a wool blanket on the concrete floor of the municipal shelter. But the mailman hand delivers the package to me just the same. I'm coiled half asleep in my box, and he leaves it at my feet. This is just the latest in a string of strange happenings in the neighborhood. The Luchos have relocated these scabby streets and started marking their territory. Every morning, freshly shattered glass shimmers on the sidewalks like dew. Kids casually cross the avenue with newly stolen car batteries tucked under their armpits like purses. There are stories about winos waking up to bloody incisions and missing kidneys. When I spot the package, I let out an involuntary yelp. But it's nothing more than a small parcel wrapped in brown paper and addressed in a magic marker scrawl that reads, "The Kid in the Alley Behind the Chinese Place on First Avenue." I can't recall if I've ever received mail here before. I'm curious but hesitate to pick it up. For the months I've been living in the city, I've been trying to avoid any intrigue. I'm still struggling to navigate these streets. My world consists of a few square blocks and ritual activities. My focus is keeping body and soul intact. I open the package with shaky fingers. This cassette tape is a genuine audio relic, tattered and beat up, but somebody decorated it with obvious care. A piece of notebook paper is neatly folded inside the plastic case, and a dozen song titles are inscribed in a barely legible hand. It's a gift. The first present I've received in ages. Of course, I don't have any way to play it, so I depart straight away to see Mr. Pastor, the man with all the gadgets and a heart large enough to share them with the likes of me. The park is nearly vacant. The sky is pitch gray. A chill wind blows loose litter over the concrete pavers, spreading it in even coats. I make my way toward the band shell, a scalloped steel structure as rusted as everything else. Mr. Pastor always camps next to the stage in an elaborate compound assembled from shopping carts, cardboard, and plastic sheeting. I kicked aside to announce my presence and wait. It takes a few minutes for Mr. Pastor to appear. He's decked out in the usual, black knit hat, mirror sunglasses, and rumpled tan raincoat. "Somebody sent this to me," I say. I lay the cassette in his massive hand for inspection. He turns it over several times, measuring its heft and testing its tactile properties. "You know who it's from?" I shake my head. "And you're not concerned about that?" "It's a gift," I say. Mr. Pastor looks at me incredulous, like, "How stupid can you be?" I blankly return his stare. Pretty fucking stupid. He shakes his head and trains his gaze back on the tape, probing the thing like it's some sort of voodoo totem, careful not to disturb its latent powers. "I'd throw this away if I was you," Mr. Pastor says, "right now." "I don't know," I say. "I kind of want to hear it first." Mr. Pastor purses his lips so hard his whole face seems to pucker. "Guess who must be the boss of you," he says. "So what do you need from me?" "Walkman," I say, "so I can listen." He sighs and ducks back inside the mouth of his compound. While he rustles through his array of cinch plastic bags and canvas totes, I turn away so I won't see where he stores his treasures. Etiquette. He reappears with a decrepit-looking Walkman, both headphones missing their phone casings. "Plays fine," he says, "just can't fast-forward or rewind." I want some privacy, so I amble toward the green benches next to the empty dog run. I sit under a clump of bare trees, slide the tape into the player, and place the plastic headphones against my chilly ears. I look closer at the handwriting on the case, the series of curlicues, dashes, odd slants, and sudden emphases, and for the first time truly begin to wonder who sent this. I press play. It takes about 15 seconds. The first strums of the acoustic guitar, and then the onslaught of rattling drums and ragged horns all at once. And that voice. Oh my God, that voice. I sit transfixed. By the time the majestic echoing chords of the last song fade, something inside me is permanently shifted. Listening to this music is like being turned inside out and finding the story of your life written on your inner organs. It's like having your blood leached to remind you that you have blood. It's like the tape ends. I flip it over and play it again and again. The singer sings with an inhuman urgency. He tells his story running, and you can almost hear the clip of hooves in pursuit. He spins out tales of drunken fathers too scared to commit suicide, dead girlfriends reincarnated as black swans or blue orchids or flaming pianos. After a while, it's hard to keep it all straight. Somebody shouts from across the park. I switch off the music. I'm surprised to find that I must have been crying because tears stream down my cheeks. Plus, there's this faint tang in the air, a damp and acrid odor. The ground is covered in fresh, grayish-green splotches of pigeon shit. I look at my coat. It's caked in moist gobs of the stuff. No idea how long I've been sitting here like this. More shouts. I turn in their direction, but it takes my eyes a few moments to focus. A gang of luchos strides towards me, six of them in black parkas, lumberjack boots, and do-rags. Behind them, a fat plume of smoke billows from the side of the bandshell where Mr. Pastor is camped. A pack of dogs barks somewhere nearby. The smart move would be to sprint headlong for the park gates. But instead, I keep my ass flat on the bench, transfixed by the cassette case. I feel like I'm on the cusp of decoding its mystery and afraid to take my eyes off the handwriting. The signature lean of the letters, the yawning O that seems open in a shout, the frenetic W that hurries past with barely a nod. These are clues. A thick gob of saliva lands at my feet. The luchos. They ring the bench, glowering like a surly Greek chorus. One smacks his glossy lips, and another rubs the vacant white orb where his cornea used to be. I try to look casual while scouting for help. The only person in sight is an elderly woman in a babushka, combing the grass for discarded crack vials. Some quick options. Run. Not fast enough. Fight. Six against one. Scream for Mr. Pastor. Judging by the fire at the banjo, I have a sinking feeling about that one, too. The tallest lucho, El Lucho Jefe, removes his do-rag, signifying serious business. "The Walkman," he says, "that's ours. Hand it over." There's only one acceptable response here. All other possible combinations of words are clustered above the same trap door and invite the same vertiginous fall. I brace myself. "It's not yours," I say. "You sit in this park," El Jefe says. "Then it's ours." He smiles, revealing inciders that have been filed to sharp points. I look at the cassette case in my palm and the tape slotted into the Walkman. That voice, the handwriting, my gift. "You can't have it," I say.
To the bottom again. Sink and swim. Sink and swim. Stand again.
This is Janet Fitch, and you're listening to Rock is Lit.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, Jeff, welcome back to the podcast.
Glad to be back.
I'm having sort of a full circle moment here because you were my guest on the very first episode of Rock is Lit back in September 2022. And now here you are on episode 50.
I'm honored to be back. It's amazing that it's 50 episodes already. Kudos to you for a lot of hard work.
You know, I owe you so much because I didn't even know there was such a critter as a rock novel until I met you. You introduced me to the work of Constance Squires, Chris L. Terry, Dana Spiota, Janet Fitch, and several other authors that I had not read. And now all of those aforementioned people have been on Rock is Lit. So this is amazing.
Oh, no, I'm so glad. It's a fabulous form, and it's wonderful that there's a podcast that's letting so many people know that these type of books are out there.
So this is actually the third time that we've talked. The first time, which is when I met you, was when I interviewed you in Charlotte for a North Carolina Literary Review. And then you came on Rock is Lit to discuss your third novel, Destroy All Monsters, the last rock novel. So this go round, we're going to focus on your debut novel, Miracopora, published in 2013 by $2 Radio.
Yeah.
Don DeLillo, who is the author of your favorite rock novel, Great Jones Street, gave the novel the following blurb. Miracopora is fine work in its manic pacing and its summoning of certain cultural emblems, present tense with a vengeance. I hope the book finds the serious readers who are out there waiting for this kind of fiction to hit them in the face. That must have been the biggest thrill.
It was amazing. I had a friend who knew DeLillo and who volunteered. He said, you know, I think DeLillo might really like this. Do you mind if I send it to him? And I was like, mind? Please. Are you kidding me? But I honestly didn't expect to hear anything back from him. And then 3 weeks later, I got this handwritten postcard from him in the mail.
Oh, my God.
And it was really incredible. You know, I literally, after receiving it, I went and sort of walked around the block a few times because it didn't quite seem real. I love not just Great Jones Street, but really all of his work. And it's been so influential to me and inspiring to me over the years. And it was just astonishing to get that blurb from him. And it was really kind of him that he also let me use it. He technically doesn't really give blurbs anymore. And so I'm one of the few writers that he's allowed to have his words attached to their book. So it's sort of an extra honor. And I'm super appreciative of his support of my work.
That's amazing. And Mira Kapora got a lot of love when it came out. Finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, Large Hearted Boy Selection for Favorite Novel of 2013, Flavor Wire Selection for Best Debut Novel of 2013, Slate Selection for Books You Shouldn't Overlook in 2013, Salon Selection for Year-End Book Guide, and on and on. And I think it was translated to Italian and French as well.
Yeah, Italian, and French, which is really great. About a year after it came out, it was published in the UK. Also, Aimee McBride picked it as her favorite book of the year for The Statesman, for The New Statesman over in the UK, which was also like a real honor and a surprise too.
Not too shabby, Jeff.
I got very, very lucky. I was very fortunate.
So. Maybe a little luck in there, but it's because it's a hell of a good book and you're a hell of a good writer. So there you go.
Well, thanks.
I know the first glimmer of an idea for this book started with your finding some of your old journals and realizing there was material there you could mine. Tell me a little bit more about that and also walk me through the evolution of the novel.
So yeah, I found these old journals that I had written when I was growing up, and discovering them, it was like reading something that had been written by someone else. It really felt like so much time had passed that I was really trying to reconnect with that person and what I felt like and what I'd been going through. A lot of the journals were written in a sort of form of fiction or sort of, I don't know, maybe teenage hyperbole about like, you know, what sort of things I was going through. There was also a really interesting confusion of fiction and confession in those journals. They seem like really great material to turn into a coming-of-age story. I thought of it as a coming-of-age story for people who normally hate coming-of-age stories, a sort of more surreal, hallucinatory coming-of-age that sort of paid tribute to that sort of sense of growing up and sort of more like what it felt like more than what actually happened.
Right.
That was something that was in a lot of the journals that I was really surprised by, was that sense of this is how it really felt, but this isn't exactly what happened. And so I was trying to be really true to the emotions and then find scenes that played out those emotions more than, I think most autobiographical stuff probably goes the opposite way. You have the scenes that happened in your life and then you try and remember exactly how it felt. I was going with like how it felt and then trying to figure out scenes that would match those emotions. The book had a really long gestation process. I think any first novel, they generally just take a much longer time to write than later books.
It took you 5 years.
Yeah. It was like a long 5 years. And there were so many different versions of the book. And there was a version of the book that was like 150 pages longer at one point that had like 40 short chapters.
Wow.
This version is like, you know, I cut, you know, 150 pages. There's like 7 long sections. And what had been the beginning of the book is now the ending of the book. So I really had to do a complete remix of it to get it to work.
At what point in the drafting process did you decide to name your protagonist and narrator, Jeff Jackson?
That actually came really late in the process, which I know surprises a lot of people. The narrator had a different name for a very long time. Even though the work came from these journals I had written, I think I had been like avoiding giving the character my name for such a long time that I finally realized I'd been sort of running away from it. And it finally just made sense toward the end that the character had to have my name, that in a certain way, the character had earned the right to my name. And maybe psychologically, I needed to write that character having a different name and then give him the name Jeff Jackson later so that there was a distance when I was writing it. And then I could bring it up closer later. But, you know, it felt right to do partially because it gave the book an urgency. It gave it some stakes. It gave it some vulnerability. It implicated me in a way that was true to the writing process. and was true to the emotions of the story. And so I'm kind of surprised looking back that it took me so long to figure that out.
To put it very succinctly, Mirakapura is a dark meditation on childhood, a story that originated from your childhood journals. So having read the novel a few times now, I can't help wondering what in the world was in your journals that would inspire such a grim tale.
I mean, there were just a lot of fantastical things. It wasn't just things that were happening to me. There were things that were happening to friends of mine. There were a lot of urban legends in the journal, too. It was interesting that one woman who read it, a playwright, she said, you know, I read Mirakapura and it didn't make sense until I found out that you were from Central Jersey. And then I just realized it's a book of realism.
Wow.
Yeah, which I was like, huh. But like, for instance, I grew up near this place called the Watchung Reservation, which there was like this abandoned village in the middle of this reservation. And there was a circus that had let loose all these like animals and monkeys into this place. There were just all sorts of, like, for a very sort of suburban New Jersey upbringing, there are all these very wild tales and all these free spaces where strange things would happen. And even if I didn't take part in all those things, people were talking about them and it was in the air. And these are a lot of the things that, you know, made it into those journals.
The novel begins when the narrator, Jeff, is 6 years old. Do your journals go back that far?
No. They don't go back that far.
Because, you know, I'm thinking about my own journals. I started keeping a journal when I was about 7. It might have been 8 or 9, but around in there. And I remember at one point, 15 years ago or more, I just had this overwhelming sense of, what if I die? And there are all these journals here that people are going to read. And so I had this moment of throwing them all away.
Oh, wow.
And now I'm kicking myself for that. So, you know, my hat's off to you for keeping all your journals and going back through them and coming up with this incredible story.
Because the journals weren't, like I said, strictly factual, they gave me a permission, I think, to be wilder with my imagination than I would have, because I realized how wild my imagination was back then. Like, I don't keep journals anymore. And that was another reason why the material seems so unusual. I was amazed that I had kept them because I didn't even remember having done so.
But we get the information about your journals in the author's note, which is a really intriguing way to begin. We also get the information that there were challenges for you distinguishing between memories and fantasies, because like you said, a lot of your journals weren't necessarily factual. So that idea of blurring the lines between memory and fantasy comes up a lot in the story. In fact, the character Jeff even tells us at one point, he says, "Maybe I'm not getting the details exactly right, but it doesn't matter. The strict facts hold no currency here." Can you talk about this friction between memory and imagination, fantasy and reality in the novel?
What I was really interested in was trying to capture this you call like a hypnagogic state, a state between sort of waking and dreaming. Those moments when you're sort of like half awake, and maybe you're partly in a dream, you can maybe control it a little bit, you maybe even hear some noises outside, the birds or whatever. That was so much of, like, when I think back on growing up, that's how I re-experienced those memories, as this sort of like quasi-dreamlike thing that has a reality to it and has a logic to it, but there's also a certain amount of dream logic that's floating through it. And so that was a way of sort of being true to the texture of those memories. And those feelings was to try and create that space that sort of blurs fantasy and reality, that is realism in a certain way, but has space for fantastical elements. And it's very interesting, too, because, like, depending on who reads the book, they have very, very different takes on where it's fantastic and where it's realist. I actually had coffee with a guy who reached out to me who had grown up on the streets. And he had read my book years later, And he said that he felt like my book was a documentary. And he felt like someone had documented his life. And it was very strange because I was sitting across this coffee shop and it felt like I was sitting across from one of the characters I had written. I was honored that a lot of what I had written resonated so much with him, that it did have a texture of reality. Other people who have like very different life experiences have seen it sometimes as completely fantastical.
Right.
It's not tethered to reality at all. I'm glad that the book allows space for people to sort of encounter it however they want to encounter it, as a more surrealist book, as something that's a real strange, gritty realism, as something in between. I think in terms of like from the section you read saying like the facts hold no currency here, I really do think like in novels, what really matters is the reality that you can bring to life on the page.
Plot involving the disappearance of the underground rock star Ken Mersey and the cassette tape recording of his final show adds an intriguing layer to the narrative. I'm a sucker for rock and roll mysteries and enigmatic rock stars, so I really love that part of the book. The excerpt that you read at the beginning of the episode is from that part of the book. And you know, I have to ask if the character Ken Mersey is based on any particular musician.
Yeah, so Ken Mersey ends up being the musician who is on this tape that Jeff listens to. And he was inspired by a lot of different people. I mean, I was thinking a lot about the idea of the reclusive rock star. You know, there's geniuses who make a couple of incredible albums and then disappear from view. So, I mean, everything going back to Syd Barrett and Skip Spence of Moby Grape to Brian Wilson in the 70s and Sly Stone, Mark Hollis of Talk Talk. I mean, even more recently, someone like Kevin Shields from My Bloody Valentine. You know, he disappeared for 20 years after Loveless and no one knew what he was doing. And even someone like D'Angelo, who, you know, seems to vanish for super long periods of time and no one has any ideas. He, you know, is he working on a new album or whatever? So I was really interested in just sort of that whole rock myth to begin with, that rock sort of lore. But there are particularly two people that I was interested in. And one of them was Jeff Mangum from Neutral Milk Hotel.
Okay.
Who at that point had disappeared, like after Over the Airplane Through the Sea, like after that record had come out, they had done a tour and then he had just sort of dropped out of sight. And in the early days of the internet, there were all these like really intense fan sites wondering about him and wondering what might have happened to him and speculating about him. And I sort of stumbled like old GeoCity sites to speak of the archaeology of the internet. And I stumbled upon these fan sites and it was just super interesting. Everyone's sort of speculations about what might have happened to him, what sort of new music he might be making, what he might be doing. So almost like the fans' reactions to his disappearance and the fact he had stopped making new music, the fact he wasn't appearing in public, that was as interesting to me as him himself.
Yeah.
You know, the fans, it was such an interesting window to see all these linked sites. I think almost all of them are gone now. I actually was looking for one a couple of years ago. I couldn't find anything. They've disappeared from the internet. There's also a story I had heard, I don't know if it's true, that in the 80s, in the early 80s, Iggy Pop was so strung out that he would go to his dealer's hotel room in Times Square and perform a private concert for the dealer and his friends, just singing karaoke on the bed so he could get his next fix.
Oh my God. I've never heard that.
Maybe because it's not true. But but I heard someone who told me that was someone who claimed to have been there for one of those performances.
Mm.
And it just sounded so sort of like insane and abject and yet potentially believable.
Yeah.
Given what Iggy had been through, that really like stayed in my mind, especially since like the person who claimed to have been there like described the scene to me. And so sort of like the combination of those sort of Jeff Mangum fan sites wondering what had happened to him, all the really, really wild speculations about him, and that story about Iggy, and then, you know, all the sort of rock lore about these reclusive rock geniuses who either because they had mental health issues, because they, you know, drugs had burned out their brains, or maybe because I heard this one critic say, sometimes people just lose their sense of destiny and just wander off. And, you know, sometimes someone, I wonder, like someone like Mark Hollis from Talk Talk, who just sort of like lost his sense of destiny as a singer and a songwriter and just decided that he was fine raising a family in the English countryside for the last 20 years of his life and never speaking about music or ever making it again.
Yeah.
And so all those things sort of mixed together to create Kin Mersey.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the cassette tape that is a bootleg of his final, supposedly his final performance. So the cassette tape is one that these kids have and they give to Jeff, and he is then tasked with passing it on to other people. And so it's sort of like this fetish object for them. So what are your thoughts about the bootleg cassette tape?
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of the cassette tape. There's something really intimate about cassettes. I think maybe because it was the first form of recorded technology that you could actually tape over. You could make your own mixtapes, record your own things on, pass it along. There's a really great book. This guy, Mark Masters, has a really great book that just came out about 6 months ago about cassette culture. That's super fascinating about sort of the lore of the cassette tape. And it's something I've always been fascinated with cassette tapes, even though I think as a medium for like presenting sound, they're terrible.
Yes.
They just sound, you know, vinyl sounds so much better. CD sounds so much better. I can think of like having Walkmans and like, you know, the number of times that a Walkman would like eat my tape. I could just see like the black magnetic tape spooling out there and thinking like, no, I just spent $15 on that.
Right.
But there's something intimate about passing a handmade cassette tape to someone than just handing an album to them.
Yeah.
It's something about a bootleg recording too. And so I invented this idea of Kin Mersey's last show, that he sort of has a collapse during, and it's this sort of crazy last show. That's what gets sort of circulated, is this recording. But it's been interesting how many people have come up to me and thought it was real.
And really?
Yes. And so someone claimed that there was a recording of Neutral Milk Hotel's last show up until that point. They've later like reunited and played, and Jeff Mangum seems to be doing well, which is really good. But like at that time, they had still not reunited, and someone claimed like, oh, I knew you were talking about Jeff Mangum because I have the tape of that Neutral Milk Hotel last show, and it's really crazy, and you really did a great job capturing it. And I'm like, I didn't know this existed, you know? I had someone from England contact me, and they were convinced that it was this cult figure in England who had disappeared before they recorded. Like this, there's this bootleg of their last show, and they were convinced it was that. I've had other people convinced it was other bands.
Wow.
With this last show. And so it's really, really interesting how, again, this sort of mythology, this lore of the last show. I mean, one thing that came out sort of after Mira Corpora was actually published was Columbia released all the recordings of Dylan's 1965-66 tours he did with the band through Europe.
Okay, yeah.
Right before, so there's the Royal Albert Hall tour, but the tour goes on beyond that, beyond after he's been called Judas and booed by the crowd. And the last performance in that is like, really, you really can hear something snap in Dylan, like something cracks. It's not as good as the Royal Albert Hall performance, but there's something so unhinged about it. The performance of Like a Rolling Stone, it feels dangerous. It feels like people are coming apart, like not just Dylan, but the band are just like, you know, fraying and unwinding before your ears. It's like no surprise at all that he had like a motorcycle accident several weeks later and broke his neck. Like you can almost hear it in that performance. And it's interesting, I thought back to that performance. I didn't know about that performance when I wrote Mira Corpora, but after the fact have almost imprinted that back on the book myself.
But you know, Dylan's another one where all of these rumors, you know, arise around that motorcycle accident. What really happened there? Did he actually have a motorcycle accident, or was he strung out on drugs and trying to kick the habit? There are all these rumors that circulated around him during that period when he virtually disappeared.
Absolutely. When he was a total recluse then, and no one had any idea what was going on, and the basement tapes were sort of a rumor that you'd get on like weird bootleg vinyl that would be like fourth generation tapes. Yeah. So, I mean, he definitely fits into that. It was interesting. Someone like Jeff Mangum, I think, who wasn't popular enough, who's popular enough to have a lot of fans on the internet, and his music meant a lot to his fans very, very deeply, but not so big that I think the media was poking into what had happened to him. And so sort of a perfect person to have these rumors sort of spread on the internet about him. This sort of low sort of subcultural rumor mill and fantasies, you know, about him.
In 2013, Large Hearted Boy published your playlist for Miracopora. I thought it would be fun to talk about some of the songs on that list and how they inform the novel.
It was so much fun to do that for the Large Hearted Boy. I did that for Destroy All Monsters as well, and it was such a pleasure.
We won't get to all of them, but here are a few that I wanted to ask you about. The first one is Terry Riley, Persian Surgery Dervishes. What does that song mean to you, and what does it mean to the novel?
So that one's a little bit more about process in a certain way. Listening to that repetitive, beautiful analog organ drones that Terry Riley created, it was a way to help me get into sort of a mental, almost trance state. I think it was helpful in creating the trance mood of the book. I felt like each section of Miracorpora needed to have this trance-like texture that would pull you along, then you wouldn't ask too many questions and you'd just sort of go with it. And it needed to have this unbroken flow. And it was almost like a vibe I was trying to capture. For whatever reason, that Terry Riley really helped me to capture that vibe, both mentally, myself in my own writing, but I think also in the prose itself.
Okay. How about PJ Harvey? The faster I breathe, the further I go.
Yeah, so that's like a rare PJ Harvey song. It's like a B-side of hers. I love PJ Harvey. I love so many of the things she's done. That song's interesting because she puts a lot of effects on her voice, which she normally doesn't do. And she's having to sort of sing and emote through this sort of scrim of fuzz and electronics. And I thought of like sometimes the voice of the narrator, the voice of Jeff, is like he's having trouble communicating as a young person, everything that's happening to him. He's having trouble articulating everything. And there's a certain amount of static he's having to speak through, almost like the static that's in his own head. It was helpful for me to like think about that. There's a beauty in the distortion on the vocals of the PJ Harvey song, and thinking about the beauty of the sort of distortedness of sometimes the narration might have. But not to be afraid of that, but to lean into that and to find the beauty in it.
Well, then we've got Alex Chilton. Alex Chilton, like Ken Mercy in your novel, had fallen into obscurity and he had problems with addiction. So the song that you mentioned in the playlist is Can't Seem to Make You Mine.
So there's this period after, you know, I mean, Big Star makes these three great records.
Yeah.
Nobody listens. Nobody pays attention. There's a really great documentary about them. It's both heartbreaking, but also wonderful to see how many people so many years later have discovered these records, how important they are. But he like puts these beautiful things into the world and like nobody pays attention. Nobody cares. You know, he has no prospects. He bums around Memphis. He does like a little bit of studio work, a little bit of recording work. He gets addicted to barbiturates and is sort of like bottoming out. You know, he's such a great songwriter. But during this time, I think it's almost too painful to write new songs. But what he can do is he can sort of inhabit older songs. And so he does this cover of The Seeds, a great garage rock band, I Can't Seem to Make You Mine. And it's so beautiful because it's so, you can hear his brokenness and his lostness, but he also funnels it into the song. Like the song is a vehicle that can carry that and can take this sort of time of turmoil and turn it into something that's artistically amazing. I love that. It's like, it's a painful version of the song, but it's also a triumph because he's found a way to take this sort of lostness he's experiencing it and turn it into great art.
Yeah. And I didn't really know much about Big Star until I talked with Dana Spiota.
Oh.
They were a fabulous band.
They were. That third record is one of my all-time favorites. It's so, so great. I mean, it's all great, but yeah.
A couple more here on your list. We've got the Future Heads' Hounds of Love. You wrote in your notes that there are surreal moments throughout Mirakulpura. There's a section set in an abandoned theme park in the woods, and you said you don't want people to pause and question what they're reading, but to keep surging ahead. And this song was an object lesson in how to achieve that. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with this song.
This is a cover of the great Kate Bush song, Hounds of Love. I think Kate Bush has become more and more popular over the years. When I wrote this, she was a little bit less, hadn't had the great resurgence that's been so well deserved. But this song is like Kate Bush, like played three times as fast. It's like really, really like almost comical, but they're so committed to it. And the wonderful sort of synth parts they do as vocal parts. All four of them are trading off vocals, doing these like crazy synth parts. And the song is just like, it's so fast. It just has this incredible gleeful velocity. And you don't have time. I mean, the lyrics in the Kate Bush song are so sort of surreal and wonderful and strange, but the strangeness of it barely has time to even register in the Future Heads song, because you're just carried along by the momentum of it. And that's what I really wanted. I was really thinking for Mirakulpura, beyond Ken Mersey, beyond the cassette tape, I was thinking a lot about rock and roll as how I wanted the book to read. I wanted this book to read like a really great rock song. I wanted it to read like a rock song that's like fast and visceral and really hits you, that there's more than you can take in one reading.
Yeah.
But that you're carried along, that you have a reason to keep turning the pages. You just sort of have a compulsion to keep reading. That was really important, so that the really strange sections about the teenage oracles, about the abandoned theme park, the gibbons that have been left to roam free in the woods, you know, that you just go along with those things, that they start to seem natural to this world.
That's how I think most of us do read it. You do go along for the ride. It is surreal. It is dreamlike. You don't worry so much about the truth of what's going on in this kid's life as much as the essence of what he's experiencing.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. That was definitely the goal. That was absolutely the goal with this, for sure. And that Future Heads song, I mean, I like, you know, the first Future Heads album is good, but that Kate Bush cover is like something real special. It's
right.
They reached places with that they were not able to go with their own material.
Well, we have to end with Sleater-Kinney, because I know that band means a lot to you, and you're the one who introduced them to me back in 2018, 2019, whenever it was we first talked. But the song on the playlist is Everything.
So that song, it's a B-side that was somehow not included on their album, The Woods. I think it's one of their absolute great songs. I love Sleater-Kinney. It's a really important band to me. I think they're one of the great power trios ever in rock and roll. And that song, I love it for the energy of it, the propulsion of it, the visceralness of Carrie and Corin's voices, the way it has this sort of headlong urgency. Greil Marcus wrote that early on in their career that it felt like Sleater-Kinney, like their songs were an all or nothing proposition. And when Janet was in the band, I think that was absolutely true. I think after Janet, their drummer left, and now they're a duo, something really vital was lost. And it's sort of, sad to me. But when Janet was in the band for the first, you know, many albums that they did together, six or seven, I think, you know, it's just amazing. And if I could have Mirakulpura feel like any rock band, like any rock song, it would be a song by Sleater-Kinney. It would be a song that has this incredible, visceral, emotional power, but that's more, like I said, more than you can sort of get on one reading, that hits you, that gives you something sort of indelible, but that you don't entirely understand. I mean, I love art that gives me sort of, I love music that gives me a visceral thrill that I can't explain at first. That I'm just sort of like, oh, you know, that was great, but like, what was that? You know, and Sleater-Kinney really does that. And that what they pack into, like, I think the 2 minutes and 30 seconds of Everything is really that.
I saw him waving at the shore, that beautiful creature I adore. Soon they were trying to restore the drowned boy.
This is Chris L. Terry, and you are listening to Rock is Lit.
Well, let's stay with artistic influences. I want to talk more about that because I think it will offer readers another perspective on the novel in terms of story, style, and structure. So let's start with some of the quotes you chose for the epigraphs of each chapter. I'm not going to do them all, just like I didn't do all of the songs on the playlist, but I do want to talk about some of them. In the first section, I begin chapter one, my year zero. Jeff is 6 years old. Here's a quote from the Mekons. "We never have to stretch our imaginations. It is our own lives we can't believe." And this is a quote from their song, Someone. So tell me a little bit about why you wanted to put that there.
Well, the Mekons are one of my absolute all-time favorite bands. And if you have not seen the documentary about them.
I have not.
I highly recommend it. I think it's called Sympathy for the Mekons. It's interesting. It has a lot of writers sort of testifying, Jonathan Franzen among them, interestingly. About
really?
Yep. It's a fabulous documentary. It gives you an idea of what's really radical and enduring about the Mekons. They come out of punk, but they also made one of the first alt-country records back in 83.
Oh, wow.
And have just traversed so many different pathways. The song Someone is on their album Rock and Roll, which is a great album, and it contains the first line of that album is maybe one of my all-time favorite rock and roll quotes, which is, "Destroy your safe and happy lives before it is too late." But I like this quote from Someone because it really seemed to speak to these issues of memory and imagination and this idea of, in some ways, what we remember and what we've lived through is even wilder than the things we allow ourselves to imagine. And the way these things blend together, you know, I think that quote encapsulates it really well. And I was just so happy to be able to include the Mekons in my first novel too, because they've meant so much to me. And I've had so many just transformative evenings seeing them play live and so many hours spent with their albums.
All right, so here's another one. We have chapter three, My Life in the Woods, when Jeff is 12 years old. Here's a quote from Robert Musil. "Suddenly, he was saying under his breath, 'We have a second home where everything we do is innocent.'" And that is a quote from his unfinished novel, The Man Without Qualities. So talk to me about that quote.
Well, I have to be honest and say, like, that quote came from a favorite book of photography by this Australian photographer, Bill Henson.
Yes.
Who did these really wonderful, strange, dreamlike portraits of sort of teenagers in these very odd locales. I do like Robert Musil's work quite a bit. He had pulled out that quote in referring to his own work.
Bill Henson and his own work.
Yeah. It's sort of a invisible way of tipping my hat to Bill Henson in my own mind, as much as it is tipping my hat to Robert Musil. But I love the idea that quote, this idea of the dream world and the memory world being as real as the real world. And this idea of when you're young, that there is this sort of like things may be rough and terrible, but there is almost this second home, even if it's just in your imagination, where everything is innocent. I thought Musil packed so much into that one sentence. I mean, it's a really, really extraordinary quote. I was really pleased to be able to use it.
Well, here's another one. This is in the I Continue section. It's chapter four, My Life in the City. Jeff is 14 years old. And it's "All True Freedom is Dark." This is from Antonin Artaud.
Yeah, I mean, I love, Artaud is really important for me. I've done a lot of theater over the years. And so Artaud's book, The Theater and Its Double, his whole idea of the theater of cruelty, his idea of actors being people that are victims, what does he say, signaling through the flames, what true acting should be. And so Artaud is like very deep in my DNA as an artist, you know, coming from theater, but just a lot of, his ideas about ritual, his ideas about inscribing meaning, about the extremity of art, the using imagination. Artaud is definitely a really key figure.
Here's the last epigraph I want to talk about. This is a quote from Robert Frank, the Swiss-American photographer and filmmaker. And it kicks off the final section of the novel, Miracopora, which is the character Jeff's piece of fiction also called Mirakapura. Here's the quote. "Passing off what might be true as fiction seems a better vocation to me than passing off what is quite possibly fiction as truth." And that just goes back to what we were talking about blurring the lines between reality and fantasy.
Well, Robert Frank, one of the things I discovered while writing Mirakapura, I had known Robert Frank's photography and, of course, his book, The Americans, is, you know, an astonishing book.
Yes.
But I discovered his filmmaking, which is also astonishing, like really, really incredible. And he sort of gave up photography for a while and concentrated on film. And a lot of the films he did were about his life. There's one called About Me, a musical, and it's about Robert Frank, but Robert Frank is played by a woman.
Oh, wow.
And so he has all these different proxies for himself and for other characters. And he really plays with this idea of autobiography and what it means and how to use elements of your life as ways to get at the truth without being literal about it.
Yeah.
And so seeing those movies, I think, gave me some of the courage to write Mirakapura and also to sort of see with the ways how free he was with his autobiography, with his own life, with using stand-ins for himself. He's a really, really great filmmaker. Of course, he also made the celebrated band Rolling Stones film.
Cocksucker Blues.
Yep.
Yeah.
which Rachel Kushner recently introduced at a screening, I think like 6 months or last year ago in LA, which was interesting. I hope that film will get more widely circulated. It's a really, really interesting piece of work.
That film was shot in the cinema verite style. Like several cameras were available for anybody in the entourage to pick up and start shooting.
He does do some recreations, though, in it, too. And the way he edits it together, he spent, I think, a year and a half editing it.
Well, then they couldn't even show it for a long time.
He could show it twice a year, and he had to be there in person.
He had to be there.
And they knew they did that because he hated to be there for showings of his work.
Ugh.
And so I got to see it at the Whitney, and I saw it on Christmas Eve. It was a lovely Christmas Eve, seeing Cocksucker Blues with friends, and then going out into and then going out into the snowy New York streets to, you know, welcome the holidays. But yeah, since he's died, I think they've been a little bit freer with how it can be shown, but it's still never been officially released on DVD. There's actually a really great Mick Jagger song that gives the title of the movie. An astonishing blues performance he gives that's in the movie. He says that he, you know, he didn't like the Stones. He didn't like the way they were treating people at the time. And in a certain way, he edited the film to make being a rock star look as unappealing as possible. Because he had all this great footage of the Stones in their prime in 1971 that he could have used.
Yeah.
And instead of using that, he shows these moments when they're very awkward or when they're behaving badly. Yeah, scenes like that, but it's a fascinating document.
Speaking of film, the book trailer for Mirakapura is really striking. Did Josh Yates create that?
He did. He had read the manuscript, and Josh is a fantastic filmmaker. I think we discussed like a couple of possible scenarios, and that was the one like we landed on. But I wasn't there for the shoot. He did a fantastic job.
He did.
Going and shooting it. It looks wonderful. Josh did a version of a short story of mine that had originally been part of Mirakapura but ended up getting cut, called The Dying of the Deads. And
he's making a film of that, isn't he?
He did, and I don't know whatever happened to it, to be honest. I've seen several rough cuts of it. It looked great. Lots of wonderful material. There was a small distributor, actually, Michael Salerno, who did the cover for Mirakapura. He has a small press called Kitty Punk, and he wanted to put out Josh's film of The Dying of the Deads. I don't know what's happened with that. The trailer for Mirakapura, he just did a bang-up job. He's a super talented filmmaker. It's a really, really captures the mood of the book and this sort of...
The essence.
And we wanted to find a scene that wasn't necessarily directly in the book, but felt like it could have been.
Jeff, I got the idea for this next bit from Peter McDade's novel, The Weight of Sound. It's a game called Only Pick One. You can only pick one from each category I'm going to throw out. You ready?
Okay.
All right, let's play the game. First category, your favorite listening device. There's a mysterious cassette tape and cassette tapes of songs that Jeff recorded off the radio mentioned in the novel. And the way that Jeff listens to these tapes really dates the story. I'm thinking 80s, somewhere around in there. Which of the following was your primary way of listening to music on the go when you were the fictional Jeff's age? We have a Walkman and we have a boombox.
Walkman, for sure.
Me too.
Yeah, it was just so portable. And I also liked listening to music when I was on the go to be more of a private experience. I wasn't into sort of sharing my sounds with everyone around me. So definitely a Walkman.
Definitely the Walkman. Okay, next category, rock and roll mysteries. Speaking of mysterious cassette tapes, that and a missing underground musician, Ken Mersey, play a big role in Mira Kapora. In fact, there are a bunch of rumors, theories, and, well, crazy theories floating around about what might have happened to Ken. Here are some other real-life rock and roll mysteries, rumors, and wild stories. Which is the most compelling to you? First one, the Beatles, Paul is dead, rumor. Pink Floyd and Dark Side of the Rainbow. Dark Side of the Moon eerily matches the action of The Wizard of Oz. Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads in Mississippi. What really happened to Brian Jones? Accidental drowning or murder? And last one, Jim Morrison faked his death in Paris and he's still alive. Which one is the most compelling?
Ooh, that's a really tough one. There's some really good choices on there. I was going to say Paul is dead when I thought that was when you're going through the two, because I think that's like a fascinating conspiracy. I should have mentioned too that reading an article in Rolling Stone about Jim Morrison's last days in Paris was somehow filtered into sort of the Kim Mersey myth.
Okay.
So that was definitely, there was a little bit of Jim Morrison floating around in there, just those last days in Paris, sort of alone, adrift, you know, whatever was happening there. All of those are really interesting, but I'm going to go to Robert Johnson just because I've been to that crossroads in Mississippi. I made a pilgrimage there with a friend. I mean, there's actually two different crossroads it could be, and there's three different grave sites for Robert Johnson, depending on what you sort of believe.
And he is the first official member of the 27 Club.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just an astonishing, I mean, so good that you're like, want to believe that the myth could be true.
We have two more categories in this game. The next one is What's in Ruth's Bag? Have you heard of the show What's in My Bag?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. So rock stars go shopping at Amoeba Records, usually in the Hollywood store, then talk about the items they place in their shopping bags. Well, on page 151, the very pregnant character, Ruth, who gives Jeff a place to stay at one point, returns home from grocery shopping and unpacks her bag. The following are items that are in Ruth's bag. Which would you most crave if you were a teenage boy living on the streets on the run from a sociopath? First item, a package of beef jerky, a sleeve of crackers, a jar of peanut butter, and I'm assuming you're not going to go for a vial of prenatal pills.
I wonder what sort of high you could get off of those pills if you took enough of them.
I don't know.
Maybe you just end up peeing a lot or something.
Maybe.
I'll skip the pills. Just instinctively, the beef jerky somehow. I think the physicality of it, something you could pull apart with your teeth.
Yeah, it's more animalistic. It takes more effort than the others.
Yeah, I think as an adult, I'd go with the peanut butter because it would last longer. But I think the teenager's not going to be thinking about, it's just going to be thinking about the immediate visceral appeal. And so I think I'm going to go with the beef jerky.
Okay. Last category, alcohol and drugs mentioned in the book. Like any good rock novel, Mira Kapora includes sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Here's a list of all the different kinds of booze and illegal substances mentioned in the novel. Which of the following would you choose to consume? Well, for whatever nefarious reason. We have gin. Jeff's alcoholic mother drank gin. We have vodka. She also drank vodka. We have beer. There are various places in the story that mention beer. We have wine. Jeff is hiding in one section, but he thinks the guy who had imprisoned him, Gert Jan, is offering Ruth a bottle of wine, and he thinks it's no doubt a formidable vintage. And then we have whiskey. We have pot. The kids in the woods that Jeff kind of hangs out with for a while, smoke joints on page 68. And then we have yellow pills / powder. The oracles use these to tell fortunes, but Kim Mersey is given yellow powder on page 119, and there's even a mention of green powder in there someplace. Which of those are you going to choose for whatever reason?
Sadly, it'll have to be the yellow pills.
Oh my God, what are the yellow pills? Are we talking acid? What is this?
I think they sort of seem to have some different properties. I suspect there's like a hallucinogenic aspect with the oracles. There's probably more of a hardcore narcotic element with what Gert Jan is doing. Some sort of opioid speed, maybe hallucinatory thing for Kin as well. If I had to have a weakness for something illicit, it would be pills for sure. So
okay,
that's what I'm going with, but not proud of it.
Well, I can just imagine the week you would have.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a very unpredictable week. You may really, I mean, it's the sort of thing where, like, more likely than not, you're going to really regret it. But there's that slight chance that you might just hit the jackpot.
Okay, fair enough. So the last time we talked, I think you were working on three novels at the same time. How's that going?
So I'm almost finished. So I'm working on a trilogy of books, and the way they're sort of done, I've had to write all three of them. I'm in the final stage of polishing all three of them now and making edits to sort of make sure that all three of them work together in the right way. And so it's been a really long journey with this. I don't know what I was thinking when I decided to write three books.
You took the yellow pills.
I did. I like definitely should not have in that case. But yeah, they're almost done. I'm really happy with them. The way they work together, I think, is hopefully really interesting. There is, of course, still a music element that runs through it.
Which means you're coming back on the podcast.
I would love to. This one's a little bit more centered around radio.
Okay.
There's actually some weird echoes of Mira Corpora in this new book. So in some ways, it's more appropriate to talk about it here than it is with Disrael Monsters.
Nice.
These new books. It has some callbacks that just seem to insist upon themselves to Mira Corpora. I'm not sure why, but they seem to definitely belong. So I think they're probably going to stay in there. But I'm glad to be in the final home stretch of working on these books because it's been a very, very long time.
I'm sure. Well, I can't wait to read them. I've devoured everything else you've written, so this is going to be a treat.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that.
What's up with your band, Julian Calendar? I know you've got a new EP out called Swimming Lessons, which I like very much. Anything else coming down the pike?
Thanks. Yeah, we do. We have, we had worked up a set of live songs, which are a bit different from the more recent EPs that we've been releasing have been a bit more electronic, a bit more based on loops and things like that. This is definitely much more rock and roll, really heavy, loud guitar. We recorded these songs that we had written for our live set, and we're really excited. We're going to be working with this amazing mixer and producer, John Agnello, who worked with Sonic Youth, has done all the Dinosaur Jr. records.
Oh my gosh, Jeff. That's amazing.
I know, it's amazing. He lives in Raleigh. A friend of ours knew him, and he listened to the music and liked it and agreed to work with us. He's also done recent albums by Waxahachie and Allvays. I mean, just a real wide variety of stuff over the years. And
wow.
He's a legend. I mean, amazing. We're so lucky to be able to work with him. And so in a couple of weeks, he's going to be mixing our record and we're going to go up to Raleigh to talk to him about the songs. And yeah, we're just super excited to see what he hears in the songs that he can bring out that we weren't even able to.
That's amazing.
And so we are so excited about that. I think it's an opportunity for the band to really sort of level up with someone like that with their ears on it and their sort of creative intervention.
Yeah.
You know, so so we're super, super excited about that.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Yeah. It's really exciting.
All right, Lit listeners, keep up with Jeff at his website, deathofliterature.com. Find him on Facebook at Jeff Jackson Author, Twitter at Death of Lit, and Instagram, Death of Literature. Pick up a copy of Mira Kapoora and his other wonderful novels at your local indie bookstore or wherever you buy books. Snag some Julian Calendar music on Bandcamp. Links in the show notes. Thanks again, Jeff.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Chrissy. It's always a lot of fun to talk to you. It's so great to be back on the show. Congratulations on 50 episodes.
Thank you so much, Jeff. If you enjoyed this first part of episode 50 featuring Jeff Jackson and his novel Mira Kapoora with music throughout by Jeff's band Julian Calendar. Stay tuned for part 2 of episode 50 when Nathan D. Duval, host of The Lucid Show on 103.3 Asheville FM, and this semester's Rock is Lit production intern Cater Jones join me to talk about a few actual musicians who, like Jeff's fictional character Ken Mersey in Mira Kapoora, disappeared. In the meantime, Wyatt, the Rock is Lit mascot, and I urge you to give us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. It'll only take a second, it won't cost a cent, and you'll get some good karma. We really appreciate your support. Until next time, keep rocking and reading and getting lit.
Rock is lit! It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.